And the symbology that Christ was using through John to show us these things was like one level of digging into the interpretation. In fact, in some places it would even go so far as to say, this is what this means. And as we continue through, then we finally open up after the letters to this vision of heaven, where we see an image of God seated on his throne, surrounded by worshipers. And that vision opens up a series of three cycles of seven, leading up to the contents of the scroll in God's hand. The first was the removal of the seven seals, those being signs of the authority and the ownership of the message to those who believe. Then we got a series of seven trumpets, warnings to those who don't believe, a call to action. And all these signs are either meant to confirm our faith or help help bring us closer to God. In the midst of those first two cycles of seven, there were also what God proclaimed as three woes. And traditionally, I kind of skip the three woes, and I remember that I accidentally almost skipped them this time because I did the first two but didn't do the third. And you know why the third one is hard? Because there's no point like the first two where it says, the first woe has passed. The second woe has passed. When we get to the second woe, it says, the second woe is past. Behold, the third is coming quickly. But the text never actually identifies where that third one is. Chances are, it's the stuff that comes exactly after that verse. So I know that's backing up a little bit, but that would be the seventh trumpet. Which, interestingly, is a picture of the Messiah and worship of the Messiah. And again, the elders falling on their faces and this message of what's actually hope. But understanding again who the trumpets were pointing to, who the trumpets were trying to call out, why could the message of Christ's deliverance, why could that be a woe? All right. That deliverance, that salvation is of no good to those who reject it. It's like how Hebrews writes, you know, how bad it is for someone who knows of Christ's glory and chooses to reject it. So it is a woe if we reject this great salvation that Christ has offered us. Now we're in the midst of another series that's going to lead to the third cycle of seven. Actually, we're starting that third cycle of seven today. Incidentally, remember, there is a secret fourth cycle of seven, right? There were the seven thunders, and what do we know about them? Cindy, you're kind of smiling. Huh? You're exactly right. We don't know anything about the seven thunders because God had told John to seal that vision up and not share it. So there's that. So there's the secret vision in Revelation that we don't actually know much of anything about other than it involved thunder. That's it. All right. Leading up to the bowls, we went through this vision, well, kind of in the midst of the trumpets, we had this vision of the witnesses and this picture of God's people sharing the gospel, sharing God's message to the people around them. and how that message was unstoppable until the power of the beast laid those messengers down in the city where Christ was crucified. But then they resurrect again and continue on their mission. We get a tiny vision of the idea that God's people are going about their work, that God's people are temporarily set back, but then God grants them victory. After the seventh trumpet and the picture of messianic delivery, then we get to this vision of a woman, a child, and a dragon. And it's the same vision. It's the same message. How God's chosen are doing his work. And in this case, it gets a little bit more explicit with the idea of the Messiah coming forth from God's people. But then they get delivered a setback from this dragon, who's identified here as Satan, who is going to persecute them, who is going to attack them, who is going to make their lives terrible. But Satan gets thrown down. But then it says he's going to stay extra fierce because he knows his time is short. He's going to make what time he has left worth all he can. And he allies himself then with these two beasts in chapter 13. Where we talked about how one could represent the worldly powers that can be wielded against God's people. And another about worship of worldly powers, be it idolatry or our own idolization of worldly powers. And all of that leads up to this vision of a reaping from heaven. God still overcomes even through all these things. And that now brings us to the bowls of judgment. Any questions, comments, brilliant insights, or epiphanies about everything that we've... That's a big question. About anything that we've done leading up to chapter 16 here before we start plowing on. Okay. The vision of the bowls is a little bit different than the other cycles of sevens we've gone through, primarily because this one just goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Personally, I'm disappointed it does that because I like the idea that there would be a pattern that's just set of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, side vision 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, side vision 7, and then, you know, here, these bowls just go boom, 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 all the way through. We don't get the anything extra. But then, after we get through the bowls here, we're going to get to one of my favorite chapters in Revelation. We're going to get to the secret decoder key of the book. So let's start in chapter 16. So I've already kind of said this one just through the introduction of the chapter. God's judgments here are described as bowls. What's significant to these people about something poured out from bowls in the midst of a conflict? Incidentally, what kind of bowls do you think these are? Are these like cereal bowls?
Oil or something like that on top of the wall in these huge bowls, and if somebody was trying to scale the wall, they pour the...
All right.
Contents on.
Right. God is keeping going with this imagery here of the spiritual warfare going on through this vision. And we've had the declaration from the king that was sealed with his seals, leading to the trumpets that would declare that a battle is coming, that would serve as a warning. And now he's using imagery as if you're atop defensive walls around a city. And these bowls, these aren't little things that you hold in your hands. The bowls of Revelation 16 are cauldrons. And that is precisely right. One of the ways you kept the walls of your city safe was by having these heated contents up, taken up onto the wall. And then when the enemy would come and they'd put their battlements up, when they would bring their ladders and try to scale the wall, you just pour the contents of the bowl down on them. Now, first century tactics here, their armor on both sides was most likely made from... Okay, you have some gold in there. Some iron. Basically metallic parts, right? What happens to you if you're encased in metal and something hot gets poured onto that metal? It all conducts heat. Have you ever accidentally grabbed a cookie sheet from the oven without an oven mitt on? Metal conducts heat. The bowls on a city wall, if they had those in place, and while the contents were active, they were kind of a short-term defense, right? They were meant to drive the enemy back from the sheer terror of what was going to happen. And again, to keep the walls of the city safe. So there are two things going on here. These are, yes, described as bowls of judgment. They are used both offensively and, this is important, defensively. This isn't just wanton destruction from God. God is using these bowls to keep something safe from the outside. Now, it helps always to go back and double check some of the Old Testament imagery that's going on here to help us understand the things that are happening. So, as you were looking through these bowls, did any Old Testament accounts, prophecies, events stick out to you as, wow, this sounds similar? Or did you find any references? Clint?
I'm just going to say, before we get to that, I was looking at the golden bowls of wrath.
Uh-huh.
Savor. And then in chapter 15, it says one of the four beasts gave to the seven angels seven golden bowls full of the wrath of God who lives forever and ever. And I couldn't help but think that there's got to be some connection there. It's like the golden bowls were associated with prayers to saints.
Yeah.
What would they have been praying for? You know, they've been killed mm-hmm. for his testimony and for their walking and following Jesus. And then there's golden bowls full of God's wrath that's being poured out in judgment on everything. I think it's God's answer to their prayers.
I completely agree with you. You are really good at making those connections between the chapters of this book, and I appreciate you making that comment. Yeah. And again, I'm really glad you said that, because one of the patterns that we do see in these visions is oftentimes by the time we get to a large vision, it has been introduced in various ways. The beasts that rise up out of the land and rise out of the sea, at least one of those beasts is introduced briefly in a prior vision. These bulls have been mentioned prior to this. There have been preparations in place. There are very few sudden cut and dry transitions in Revelation. Of course, and I fall to this temptation too, because in our modern Bibles, everything is chopped up into these chapters. We tend to view things in a very cut-up way. This is this vision, this is that vision, this is this vision, and they live in their own little microcosms. This is all one big vision that flows through a set of related visions, but it's all connected. So I'm really glad you brought that out and reminded us of the connections that we've seen up to this point. Thank you, Clint. Now, connecting things back even further, what Old Testament parallels did you see here that would have had meaning to the first century readers? Okay. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
The water turned to blood. The light of darkness.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the first thing that popped into my head immediately, too. Is the very first thing we see here is we have the painful sores or the boils breaking out. Then we have two bowls in a row that involve water turning to blood. Now, of course, in the events leading up to the Exodus, that was one plague. Right here it splits out between the sea and then smaller bodies of water. Then we have the sun burning people with fire, remembering you have the fire falling down from heaven back during the plagues. You have the darkness. So yeah, I mean, immediately here, God is invoking imagery of deliverance. Again, terrible events, but deliverance. By invoking those images, God is saying to his people, I am freeing you from captivity. What is he protecting with these bowls? He's protecting his people. He's protecting his city that we're going to read about a little bit later. Did you notice anything else other than the plagues in here? Go ahead, sir.
Each time they continue to curse God and not look at the signs that they're being given, that these are miraculous signs, and that they should recognize that there is a sovereign God.
Okay.
Instead, they double down on their ungodliness and their hate for God's people.
And we saw this back, we saw the same pattern with the trumpets, didn't we? The trumpets called out a warning through the events that were happening alongside them. And yet, it says that the people continued in their rejection of God. Here we have, through this part, you know, one example is with the fifth bowl. People gnawed their tongues because of their pain and blasphemed the God of heaven. They did not repent of their actions.
In Deuteronomy, in the 28th chapter, God puts condemnation on the unbelieving Israelites, which would have some of these things brought upon them, such as a boil. Then in Isaiah, you have the darkness again spoken of in Isaiah 8, chapter verse 21-22. And then as far as the water being dried up, that's Isaiah 11, chapter verse 16-16.
Yeah. And the interesting things then, we have a connection between the events of Exodus and Deuteronomy, and then a connection with the events in Isaiah. What great historical event in Israel's history was Isaiah leading up to?
The destruction of Jerusalem, basically.
Okay, the destruction of Jerusalem. the great Babylonian captivity. And there was also a promise with that captivity. And what was that promise?
That a remnant would be saved.
Excellent. That a remnant would be saved. Tied up in the prophecies of destruction and despair was a promise of deliverance for those who were truly faithful. Incidentally, I do think we actually have a tiny extra side vision in the middle of the sixth one here. The sixth bowl poured out on the river Euphrates, and its water was dried up to prepare the way for the kings from the east. Then I saw three unclean spirits like what? I know, right? Frogs? I don't know what I was expecting that next word to be the first time I read this, but I can tell you it was not frogs. Three unclean spirits, like, oh, frogs, coming out of the dragon's mouth, from the beast's mouth, and from the mouth of the false prophet. All right, so what I'm seeing here is that there's one frog each. I don't think it's three frogs each. I think it's one frog each. There's one frog coming from the dragon, and then a frog each coming from each of the beasts that the dragon gives powers to. And what does it say about these frogs? I'm sorry? Yeah, that they're unclean spirits. They're spirits of demons, and what are they doing? They're working miracles. Okay.
But I think that the miracles they're working are to enable the ungodly. It almost strengthens their cause to even be more ungodly. And that's the lie. That's the lie that they believe. That's why the man believes right now. They get enabled.
Yeah.
Encouraged. Uh-huh. To be defiant towards our Heavenly Father.
Excellent, yeah. And there's a really good precedent why these are frogs. I'm going to go all the way back to Exodus 8. And I'm going to start in verse 5. Actually, no, I'm going to start in verse 1. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go into Pharaoh and tell him, this is what the Lord says. Let my people go so that they may worship me. But if you refuse to let them go, then I will plague all your territory with frogs. The Nile will swarm with frogs. They will come up and go into your palace, into your bedroom, and onto your bed, into the houses of your officials and your people, into your ovens and kneading bowls. The frogs will come upon you all, your people, and all your officials." The Lord then said to Moses, "Tell Aaron, stretch out your hand with your staff over the rivers, canals, and ponds, and cause the frogs to come up into the land of Egypt. When Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, the frogs came up and covered the land. But the magicians did the same thing by their occult practices and brought frogs up onto the land of Egypt." Now, we don't get any more details about what the magicians did. There's a part of me that thinks this is actually probably the lamest magic trick in the entire Bible, because the land was already swarming with frogs, and then the magicians are look, frogs just came out of our sleeves. Isn't that awesome? I don't know. But whatever they did, it, to your point, emboldened Pharaoh. Pharaoh's heart hardens at this point. He sees this false sign from his magicians, and it leads him to the incorrect conclusion that he is on equal footing with this Lord God Yahweh who's demanding his people be let out of Egypt. And therefore, he does not repent. And therefore, he continues to fight against God. All the way back here in Revelation, These are the spirits of demons performing signs who travel to the kings of the world to assemble them for the battle of the great day of God the Almighty. These are whatever forces there are that embolden, that empower, that give confidence to anyone who would stand against God. And just like in the days of Pharaoh, where there were already frogs everywhere, and there had to have been a big dose of Pharaoh seeing what he wanted to see to be convinced that his magicians were doing just as good as God. We have the same challenges today, that sometimes when we are in a position where we are being led away, where we feel emboldened against God, when we harden our hearts, it's because we see what we want to see. And we let that lead us astray. So we get to this great battle in here. I'm sorry, I lost my place. There we go. So after these kings feel empowered to rebel against God, they assemble at a place that is called in Hebrew Armageddon. That's another one of those words that even if someone who just has a glancing knowledge of the Bible knows almost nothing of the book of Revelation, you know, they'll know the mark of the beast. They'll know the four horsemen of the apocalypse. They'll probably have a passing familiarity with the dragon being thrown down. This is another one of those words that almost anyone will have some kind of context of. Armageddon. Let's step outside of our Revelation shoes for a minute. Let's step outside of our context. In American pop culture religion, when you see references to Armageddon, what do you usually see? What images conjure up in your mind? Okay, nuclear war.
Destruction.
Conceptual idea of the world's view of God's kingdom is that he's going to establish his kingdom back in Jerusalem.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, this great battle that's going to consolidate world power back in Israel and Jerusalem and institute this 10,000-year reign, right? Unfortunately, in our modern culture, we've made the same mistake. And I hate to say it, but there are entire national policies built around this false doctrine. But we've made the same mistake that the Pharisees made all the way back with the Messiah. Many of the Pharisees and other influential Jewish teachers, when they were looking for the Messiah, do you remember, what were they actually looking for?
An earthly kingdom.
They were looking for an earthly kingdom.
Like David.
Yeah. They were looking forward to this person who wasn't going to come and save them of their sins. We've already got sacrifices for that, guys. We weren't looking for anyone who was going to come and sacrifice themselves for us. We were looking for somebody who's going to come and deliver us from Roman captivity and reinstitute the great Davidic kingdom, reestablish the temple, and beat down our enemies. That's why Jesus was such a radical disappointment to so many of the Jewish religious leaders of his day, because they had taken the prophecies of this prophet, priest, and king, and instead they separated them out into different people. And they were looking for maybe someone who is a prophet and a priest, but then also this great war leader, this king, the once and future king of Israel, who would lead them to their grand worldly victories. And so when the Messiah was something that they weren't expecting, they rejected it. Guys, we can sometimes fall for that same thing, even though we may academically, on paper, understand that we're not looking for an earthly kingdom. We can sometimes get caught up in the false doctrines that surround Revelation, and even though we might say we don't believe those events are going to happen, we can still get caught up in the attitudes and behaviors that surround them, as if we're looking for some kind of worldly deliverance. Go ahead, Dad.
Talking about souls, he pulled out Zechariah.
Yay, Zechariah.
Terminology in the 12th chapter. And I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication, so that they will look on me whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for the only son, and they will weep bitterly over him like the bitter weeping for the firstborn. And in that day there will be great mourning in Jerusalem, like the mourning of Hadad-Rimmon in the plain of Megiddo.
And that then brings us to full circle. Let's talk about what God's actually describing here. And yes, we have this prophecy in Zechariah that invokes images of bulls. It's very messianic in its nature. What was it Zechariah 4?
12.
Let's head over there. Thanks. All right. I'm going to read that again, and just in case not everyone could hear it. Then I will pour out a spirit of grace and prayer on the house of David and the residents of Jerusalem, and they will look at me whom they pierced. They will mourn for him as one mourns an only child, and weep bitterly for him as one weeps for a firstborn. On that day, the mourning in Jerusalem will be as great as the mourning of Hadad-Rimmon in the place of Megiddo. The land will mourn, every family by itself, the family of David's house by itself and their women by themselves, the family of Nathan's house by itself and their women by themselves, the family of Levi's house by itself and their women by themselves, the family of Shimei by itself and their women by themselves, all the remaining families, every family by itself and their women by themselves. We come up to a name here that sounds really similar to what we have rendered as Armageddon in Revelation. We have this Megiddo. Talk to me about that. Mm-hmm. That's excellent. Yeah. great battles happening at Megiddo or Megiddo date all the way back to the days of Joshua. This was a common place where some sort of epic battle would happen in the history of the Israelites. So when we get to Revelation 16 here, he says that they have gathered in this place that is rendered in Hebrew, Armageddon. And that's the only place that those letters are found altogether in that order in the Bible. But if you actually pull it apart, this is making reference to that Megiddo. We're just seeing some time and culture differences in spelling. Okay. Go ahead.
I think the word...
You have a voice. I'm so happy.
Thank you. The word actually means, in Hebrew, my understanding is Mount of Megiddo.
Yeah.
But there's no literal place called the Mount of Megiddo.
Right.
It's a plain, it's a valley. There's no mountain there. So this is not a reference to a literal place, but using that imagery of great battle, tragic battle, and here it's the enemies of God that are suffering.
Right, and I think the inversion is important. I'm really glad you brought that up, Emerson. Yes, Megiddo is a valley. And instead here it's being called a mount. But as Emerson brought out, as Clint brought out, some of those battles that happened in Megiddo were, in the valley, were tragic. They were actually low points in Israel's history. But here, God says this battle is going to take place in Megiddo, but not in the valley, but on a mount. And almost universally, how does God use the imagery of mountains in prophecy?
Power, might?
Yeah, his power, his might. Go ahead.
The only thing I was thinking of was that the battle was being fought on God's terms.
Okay, yeah. Excellent. Being on God's terms. Dad, you were going to say something?
You've got the idea of Zion also.
Yes.
God's city, and it's already been called Zion here in the book of Revelation.
Excellent. Absolutely.
What I thought was...
Yeah.
The mountain that also, I think, refers to the high ground.
Uh-huh.
If you look at the battles back then, it was those that had the high ground that had the advantage.
Yeah.
And we've seen that through battles throughout the history of man. So that's part of you know, the high ground. God will hold the high ground and then have the advantage.
Right, exactly. So this imagery of God's deliverance, this imagery of God's advantage, having the high ground, this imagery of his kingdom even, the great Mount of Zion, possibly. And then they gather at this, and the seventh bowl pulls out. And what do we hear a loud voice saying?
It is done.
It is done. What do you immediately think of when you hear the words, it is done? Yeah. Christ's ultimate victory over sin on the cross. It is done are the words of God's victory. And then we have here, there were flashes of lightning and rumblings of thunder. A severe earthquake occurred like no other, since man has been on the earth, so great was the quake. The great city split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. Babylon the Great was remembered in God's presence. He gave her the cup Filled with the wine of his fierce anger, every island fled, the mountains disappeared. Enormous hailstones, each weighing about 100 pounds, fell from the sky on people. And the people do what? Right. Which brings me to, starting to wrap up here, do these seven bowls represent God's final judgment of all mankind? Clint's saying no. Why not, Clint?
Just because there's more to come.
There is more to the book. You're right. There's more to come. Spoiler alert, there are more chapters left. Yeah, didn't say the end. Go ahead. All right. The people have a chance to respond to these judgments. When we're pictured the great final judgment that Jesus gives us back in Matthew 25, where he separates the goat from the sheep, there's no chance there for people to decide to blaspheme Christ after judgment, is there? Yeah. I was trying to remember where that one was. Okay. Yeah. This is not over. But I think what we are seeing is wrapping up this idea that God is promising his people that he will protect them. We are continuing this theme. There's the promise in this book that God is going to remove, for these Christians here in the first century, he is going to push aside the institutional and systematic obstacles in the path that are meant to inhibit his message from reaching all that it can. And here I think we see the final victory of that removal. We are seeing the point where God is saying, this is how I will overcome. I will remove Babylon from being in your path. Now, I think we've already gotten a pretty good definition of Babylon so far as we've been working in the book. But when we get to chapter 17, an angel is going to spell it out for us. Again, I like calling chapter 17 here the decoder ring of Revelation. It works on a symbolic level, and it works on a literal level as well. And that instills a bit of confidence in me that the clues are pretty clear here. Any more questions, comments, brilliant insights, and or epiphanies before we wrap up? Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, the hail that's falling, 100-pound hail.
Yeah. That's big.
Making a reference to the frogs of Egypt.
Yeah.
Only the Egyptians. Okay, and the hailstones only fall on the bad people?
In the case of the Exodus, they did. I think you're making some sense, yeah.
Frogs were in, I got the impression from other studies, they weren't everywhere, they were only with the Egyptian people.
Uh-huh.
You know, so.
And I want to come back to the very beginning of this vision, how it's picturing these bowls being poured down on God's enemies. That infers the presence of walls. The bowls are being poured outward from the walls. which means the inhabitants of the city are protected from the contents of those bowls. The bowls don't back up and pour upon the citizens. The bowls only pour in one way. So I think the usage of Egypt here works in that way as well. God's people were protected from the plagues. I think what he's describing here, whatever these signs ultimately mean, God is using them as judgment against those who are against him, but he is protecting his own. All right, that was the second bell. Let's get ready to worship. We'll get into Revelation 17 next time we're together. Thanks so much.